I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:33 p.m. on Wednesday, April 26th, 2017. Present today, we do have Representative Ortiz, Kawasaki, Wilson, Guttenberg, Representative Quinn, Thompson, Tilton, Vice Chair Guerra, Co-Chair Seaton, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. Before we start, please mute your cell phones. Now, this meeting, we'll be having our second hearings on HB 131, the Relocation Assistance for Federal Projects and Programs, HB 128, the Shellfish Enhancement Projects and Hatcheries Bill, HB 76, the Mariculture Revolving Loan Fund Bill, and HB 124, the Benefit Appropriations Bill. And it's my intent, if it is the will of the committee, to move these four bills from House Finance today. So with that, our first piece of business is HB 131, the Relocation Assistance for Federal Projects and Programs. And the committee last heard this bill on April 6th, and my office did not receive any amendments. So at this time, I'd like to call Matt Gruning, aide to Representative Louise Stutes, and the House Transportation Committee to the table. And so, Mr. Gruning, if you could put yourself on the record, and if there's anything else that you'd like to add.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Matt Greening, staff to the House Transportation Committee. As the chairman indicated, it's been about a month since this bill was heard, so I was intending to do a short refresher, if that's okay with the chairman and the committee. I would be remiss, however, if I didn't mention that Laura Seidoff, who previously presented this bill, has a pretty good reason for not being here today. I'm pretty pleased to announce that at 3:58 a.m. this morning, Laura gave birth to an 8-pound, 15-ounce baby boy, and both the mother and the baby are in perfect health. So. Thank you. With that, in front of you is House Bill 131, the Federal Relocation Assistance Programs Projects. This will bring Alaska into compliance with federal law concerning reimbursement for relocation expenses incurred by individuals or businesses that were displaced due to a federally funded highway, bridge, or facilities project. Alaskans deserve to be fairly compensated in these circumstances. House Bill 131 will also protect Alaska's approximately $700 million annual allocation of Federal Highway Administration and Federal Aviation Administration funding by bringing the state back into compliance. $500 million is allocated annually from the Federal Highway Administration, and on average, $200 million is allocated from the Federal Aviation Administration. Having an equivalent state statute is one of the requirements for a state to receive a delegated authority to independently administer the federal program. Additionally, being out of compliance for even a short period of time jeopardizes our relationship with our funding partners, putting the entire program at risk. These projects, as I mentioned before, currently amount to about $700 million annually in federal participation as well as countless jobs. And as just a little bit of background for why this is necessary again, in 2012, Congress relaxed the eligibility criteria and increased the maximum reimbursement limits for states' relocation assistance payment programs when they passed their Transportation Authorization and Funding Bill, the Moving Ahead for Progress in the 21st Century Act, aka MAP 21. Prior to MAP 21, the payment rates hadn't changed for 30 years. Those changes went into effect on October 1st, 2014. Unfortunately, Alaska statute continued to reflect the more stringent eligibility criteria and smaller maximum reimbursement limits. During the second half of the 29th Alaska Legislature, this inconsistency between state and federal law was almost addressed as language similar to House Bill 131 was proposed, passed this body, passed through several committees in the other body, and then was held in that body's Rules Committee and was never scheduled for a floor vote. House Bill 131 assures Alaskans that their legislature wants them to be compensated the same as residents of any other state. That concludes my comments. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today, and I would note that Heather Fair, the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities statewide right-of-way chief, is here to answer any technical questions.
Mr. Chairman, so I just want to put it on the record. Last time we had this, that there approximately would be $12,000 of state funding, 9%, although we have a zero fiscal note. I just want to make sure that's correct.
That is correct. It is through the chair, excuse me. That is a Representative Wilson. It is a zero fiscal note, and it's approximately 91% on average, federal funding with 9% state match.
And a follow-up? Mr. Chairman, this is to you, not to Mr. Gruning. Why would we have a zero fiscal note if we know there's – I mean, I'm fine with the bill. This is more of a fiscal bill, fiscal issue, because it is 91%, 9%. So why would we have not gotten something showing that 9% on here? Maybe that's a department question?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, Heather Fair, statewide right-of-way chief for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities.
Did you hear the question?
I did. Mr. Chairman, to answer your question, why we have a zero fiscal note instead of addressing that minor 9%, give or take $12,000 that we're estimating in liabilities, the simple answer is that we will design projects based on available state funding and absorb that additional cost when we allocate projects.
Follow up?
Representative Wilson.
But Mr. Chairman, this is retroactive back to 2014, so there will be no... So you're just basically saying even though there may be funding that's needed for 2014, that you have enough in your budget to be able to just absorb it within Department of Transportation?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, that's correct. As we estimated, it's about $12,000 liability to the state, so it's small enough that we can absorb it back to 2014.
We might need to take a closer look at their budget next time. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. These are state projects, but I'm going to expand the conversation with a question. Recently, the railroad acquired a lot of right-of-way. That's in question whether they had the authority to do that. Would this cover what the railroad was doing? They're acquiring right-of-way, but they're not requiring it for capital projects. This bill is talking about compensating people and property and farms for capital projects or taking right-of-way or to do those things. But would this cover the... actions by the railroad as well, or is that a separate state corporation outside of this?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, they are a separate corporation, and this does not address their operations.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's an interesting question. I don't know if we need ledge finance for this, but I understand the explanation of the zero fiscal note. That's because these projects will be dependent on there being a federal project in the future and then us having to pay to relocate a family, which obviously we would. So you don't know when that's going to happen or how often that's going to happen, and that would be in the capital budget. It's not like it's an ongoing operating budget expense that we normally see in a fiscal note. But do we – I guess the question remains, so – Yeah, I guess the question remains, it's a, we know there will be some expenses in the future. We don't know what they will be. We know we'll pay for them. But since it's not an operating budget expense, it's ongoing, that's why it's a zero fiscal note?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, that's correct. It's very difficult to estimate how we will impact businesses, farms, and families with future projects. But we do take that into consideration when we have the statewide transportation improvement program, the STIP. And again, we prioritize projects based on available funding and need.
Just one more question, sir.
Representative Guerra and then Wilson.
Yeah, so it's not like in the future you plan on reaching into your operating budget funds to pay for this. You'll request capital budget funds that'll be the 9%. So we know there'll be a request. Is that right?
No.
Representative Guerra, through the chair, that's correct. And again, we expect it to be a de minimis impact to the state.
And Representative Wilson.
Follow up to Representative Guerra question. So reaching back was just from the 2014, not going forward. So going forward, though, would be when you come with a project, and let's say it's a million-dollar project, within that project will be possibly relocation funds already allowed to be utilized with the federal funds. And we already matched those projects by 10%. So I think what we were talking about before was only going back, the retroactive part, where those funds were going to come from. Going forward, this will be part of the grants that come from for our transportation program, whether it's right-of-way access that we have to get or whether it's just the project itself. So that 10% match will what we'll normally see in the capital budget today.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, yes. And to clarify, that roughly $12,000 state liability is actually retroactive to date as well as what we can foresee in the next year to 2 years horizon on the known projects.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Are there further Representative Guttenberg has a question.
Yeah, not a question, maybe half a question, half a statement. So a capital appropriation for a project going forward, at the beginning when you give us a number or take it out of the STIP or the FMATS or the AMATS, wherever it comes from, built into that is all the engineering and all the property acquisition and right-of-way, and now we're authorizing you just simply to have this as part of that process so that when you're looking at the expenses going into a project, it would be that 10% would be built into it, either add on to it or absorbed into it. But it's enclosed inside, looking forward, it's enclosed inside a capital project bid document. Or for it would be part of the department's bid document, not the capital, not the actual construction part of it. So we really wouldn't see it in a budget item. It would just be as much as engineering or acquisition or right-of-way research or all those things. So we're not going to see this anymore as far as in a bid document or a capital project. And is that an accurate assessment?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, it's accurate that you won't see a line item for it. You're currently also not seeing a line item for it, as it's already something that we pay. It's just now there's new limits.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no further questions. Ed, public testimony, Dean.
Yeah, we did public testimony already.
Yeah. Representative Guerra, would you like to run us through the fiscal note?
Sure, Mr. Chair. We have one fiscal note. It is OMB component 2357. It shows a zero fiscal impact. I think we've discussed that on the record. And that's it.
Are there any questions about the fiscal note? Seeing none, I have a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move that we pass House Bill 131, Version D, out of committee with individual recommendations and the one fiscal note.
And that is a zero fiscal note. So, is there objection? Seeing no objections, House Bill 131, Version D, we'll move from committee with individual recommendations and attach zero fiscal note. And we'll take just a brief at ease. Okay, we're back on the record in House Finance, and the next piece of business is House Bill 128, the Shellfish Enhancement Projects and Hatchery Bill. We last heard this bill on April 14th, and there were no amendments turned in to the co-chair's office. So at this time, I'd like to go ahead and let Representative Ortiz refresh us on this bill, and go ahead and put yourself on the record.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Dan Ortiz. I represent District 36, Southern and Southeast Alaska.
Mary Hockler, Representative Ortiz's staff.
Thank you, Co-Chair Seaton, and members of the committee, for again considering HB 128, dealing with shellfish enhancement projects. Just a brief reminder of what this bill does. It advances mariculture opportunities in Alaska through shellfish enhancement projects. Very briefly, it allows nonprofits to apply for and pursue enhancement or restoration projects involving shellfish. They may include red and blue king crab, sea cucumber, abalone, gooey duck, razor clams, plus other shellfish species not yet on the radar. HB 128, Mr. Chairman, holds the Department of Fish and Game to a very high standard in the process of issuing permits, specifically requiring the commissioner to make a finding of substantial public benefit and a determination that the project would not jeopardize natural stocks. It's important to note that when shellfish are released back into the wild by a permit holder, the shellfish become a common property resource available for common use. In summary, Mr. Chairman, this bill holds the promise of diversifying and strengthening Alaska's fishery portfolio by establishing a sound, sustainable approach to growing the state's fledgling mariculture industry. And this bill has 2-0 fiscal notes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, Representative Ortiz. I appreciate this bill a lot. So while we're enhancing the shellfish, why would we not use the enhancement for our hatcheries that we're putting a lot of money into as well? Because I'm just going by the title on page 1, line 3, when we're talking about salmon hatchery permits.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. This particular bill is designed to, again, to jumpstart the mariculture industry. There already is in existence a number of fish hatcheries or salmon hatcheries in the state of Alaska that, you know, those were put in existence a number of years ago. And you know, there's nothing to say that there couldn't be other hatcheries put forward in the future, fish hatcheries. This particular bill, however, addresses the issue of the mariculture industry. So with that, that might not be a suitable answer, but it is the answer.
Follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow-up, President Wilson.
Did we have somebody here from Fish and Game?
Yes.
I know we did.
Welcome. Would you go ahead and put yourself on the record and take your Wilson's question, or would you like to repeat?
Thank you. For the record, my name is Forrest Bowers. I'm Deputy Director of the Division of Commercial Fisheries. Could you repeat the question, please, Representative Wilson?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. So in this bill, we're enhancing shellfish, which I think is great, you know, more into it. And I'll just use the example of the interior hatchery, where we have a lot of fish, but the fish can't be put into this, into the river, because I'm not exactly sure what the fish will do. But since we have a vehicle here, don't you think there's some enhancement that we might be able to do for our hatchery, so there's more opportunity there as well as not just for shellfish?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. So right now, there are laws in place that allow for fish, salmon, trout, char, fish species. There are laws in place that allow for, you know, enhancement or rehabilitation, hatchery operations, whatever you want to call them. those laws have been in place for many years. There are no laws in place that allow for shellfish fishery enhancement. That's the intent of this bill. So right now, a person cannot apply for a permit to do a shellfish fishery enhancement project. That's the intent of this bill. It would allow enabling regulations and a permitting process to be put in place where a person could apply for and receive a permit to enhance a shellfish fishery. So there's already, as you pointed out, there is already a fish enhancement, a hatchery program in place for fish. This would establish a parallel program for shellfish.
We'll follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up, Representative Wilson.
And maybe I'm missing something. So there is a nonprofit way of doing salmon enhancement projects, similar to this, where I can, as a nonprofit, have, or they could maybe use the hatchery that the state is, be able to have salmon there and then release them out into the Chena or the Yukon River or wherever that need is. We can currently do that?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes, we have examples of that all over coastal Alaska.
Well, very good, because I was told we couldn't do that, so thank you.
And just a clarification, releasing into the wild can be different than raising the fish. You have to have permits that allow you to non-competitively with wild stocks be able to release those fish. But enhancement is a... Hatcheries are done by nonprofits all along the Gulf. In fact, that's a majority of. We have a number of letters that I think came in your packet of people that were somewhat opposed to the massive amounts of pink salmon that are going through nonprofit hatcheries and being released out. So there is some contention there, and just wanted to make sure we all that we had Representative Thompson and Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The only one I'm more aware of is the hatchery on the Gulkana River between Summit Lake and Paxson Lake. That one is a nonprofit that's funded by the fishing industry. Different parts of it add to that. Those fish are fertilized there. They take those and put them up into a lake there in the interior, and hundreds of thousands of them. And then they put them back into the river that goes to the Gulkana, the copper, and everything. So that's, I think, what you're speaking about is that type of a setup is already in place.
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, that's correct. That's an example of a fish enhancement project through a private nonprofit. And just to amplify, expand on my answer a little bit to Representative Wilson, a permitting process is in place, but that doesn't mean that the department would necessarily grant or approve every application. So some of, you know, you may have heard from folks in your district who had discussed a potential project with us, and they might have received some negative feedback on that. But there is statutory and regulatory language in place that at least allows them to apply for the permit.
And Mr. Chairman, on that, I actually was told by the fish hatchery in Fairbanks that they could not put them in, and kind of very similar to the reasons the co-chair said, that they aren't, that they were not allowed to put them in the Yukon because of the whole raised and wild and the mixture. But after this or whatever, I'd like to really clarify that, because there is a lot of money going in there, and we have some real issues with how far the fish population is. And, you know, if we've made these hatcheries to try to take care of it, now we can't. That's just really what I was trying to figure out. So I haven't had any nonprofits or my district, but I was actually told by the hatchery in Fairbanks that they could not do it.
Thank you, Sparrows. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but I mean, I would not want to recklessly or like hastily add a fish hatchery provision in here. I mean, there, one of the concerns obviously is with king salmon, for example. There's been a lot of controversy about adding hatchery kings into a wild king salmon stream, right? I mean, there are considerations like that that we'd have to be very well studied up on before we went forward on something like that, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that's correct. And so the only part of this bill that doesn't relate to shellfish is the application fee. It raises the application fee for a new salmon hatchery permit from $100 to $1,000. Everything else in the bill relates to shellfish fishery enhancement, but that it, that little piece related to the salmon hatchery permit application fee is in there, and so that's kind of where the word hatchery gets drawn into the title.
Thank you, sir. I'm comfortable with this being a shellfish bill, and I'd be uncomfortable expanding it.
Thank you. Are there further questions for the sponsor? And return. Pass the gavel back.
Okay, so if there are no further questions, looks like we are down to walking through the fiscal notes. If there's nothing else, is there anything else?
No, there are.
Good. Okay. Okay, Representative Gere.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have 20 fiscal notes. The first is OMB component 2171 for the Department of Fish and Game, Commercial Fisheries, Statewide Fisheries Management. And the other fiscal note is OMB component 471 for the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, also a 0 fiscal note. And those are the only two fiscal notes that we have.
Any questions on the fiscal notes? See no questions. If I can have a motion to move the bill from committee.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 128, version D, with attached 0 fiscal notes and individual recommendations out of committee.
Are there any objections? Seeing no objections, House Bill 128, version 30-LS0449/D for Delta is reported out of House Finance Committee with individual recommendations and the attached 0 fiscal notes. And so with that, if folks could take a moment to sign the report, and we'll move right into the next order of business, which is HB 76, the Mariculture Revolving Loan Fund Bill. And we last heard this bill on April 14th, 2017, and there were no amendments turned in my office. So at this time, I'd like to call Representative Dan Ortiz and his aide, Elizabeth Bowling, to the table. And if you could both, again, just put yourselves on the record and refer to the committee on HB 76.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, my name is Dan Ortiz. I represent Southern Southeast Alaska District 36.
And Mr. Co-Chair, my name is Elizabeth Bowling. I'm staff to Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, and members of the committee for again considering HB 76, which also deals with the mariculture industry. This bill, Mr. Chairman, amends the existing Alaska Mariculture Revolving Loan Fund to allow up to 40% of the fund to be used for loans to permitted shellfish hatcheries for planning and construction and operation. Alaska shellfish farms currently do not have a stable supply of seed for the propagation of oysters and no regular in-state source of seed for resident aquatic plants or other shellfish. A stable supply of seed is one of the many hurdles the industry must overcome to grow and become a viable Alaska industry. Mr. Chairman, this bill will amend the program to shift its focus and eligibility from individual mariculture farmers to include shellfish hatcheries that would market stock to local Alaskan mariculture farmers. And there are 20 fiscal notes attached to this bill, and if there's any further questions, we stand ready to answer those.
Okay, and just so folks know, available for questions, again, Brittany Sione Haywood, Division Director at the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. Jim Anderson, Loan and Collection Manager at the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. So with that, do we have any questions of the committee? Okay. Seeing no questions, Representative Gere, if you could again walk the committee through the fiscal notes for HB 76.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're working fast. I'm still signing the last one. We have 2 fiscal notes for House Bill 76, Fisheries Committee version. OMB component 2175 is a 0 fiscal note. That's for the Department of Fish and Game statewide support services at the Commissioner's Office. We have OMB component 383 for the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, appropriation allocation investments, also a 0 fiscal note.
Are there any questions on the fiscal notes? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on component number 383 in the last paragraph, it says this legislation would create a new loan type and therefore require updated regulations, a new application, training of loan staff, and internal policy and procedures. So is this another department that has more than enough money to absorb these costs? Because we had one on HB 103 that was a $5,000 fiscal note because they had to rewrite some regulations. So do we have an anticipation of what this would have cost?
And members from the department.
I think they left you.
And if you could put your name and affiliation on the record.
Thank you, committee. My name is Brittany Choney Haywood. I'm the director for the Division of Economic Development in the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. The fiscal note with the regulations and stuff, the funding will come out of the fund, and there's potentially another regulation package that'll be happening as well.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson?
Okay, first of all, I'm not sure what fund it would come out of, but should that still not be reflected in the fiscal note?
We've got two comments. Representative Seaton and then Guerra.
Well, I mean, that was a question. I mean, in the fiscal note, you know, if it's coming out of another fund, and that's what they just said, it should show that that potential would be what the amount it would be and then what that designated general fund would be.
Okay, Representative Seaton and then Guerra, and then we'll come back to you, Ms. Haywood.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The rest of that bottom paragraph is, these adjustments will be included in a planned regulations project and updates, and no fiscal impact is anticipated from this legislation. So if they're already rewriting the regulations, then if it's going forward with that packet, I believe that that's what this is implying, but maybe the department can let us know more fully.
Ms. Haywood?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, my understanding and what I was told from my budget office within the department is that we weren't asking for additional money, and so for an additional appropriation, and so therefore it was a zero fiscal note.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. I just wanted to point out that this is not fish and games fiscal note. This is commerce, and it's part of the loan programs, which they have a lot of. If you look at the top line in that analysis, the Mariculture Resolving Fund authorized to do loans already. It's just redoing what they already have and including it with other projects is what it looks like to me.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I guess the question then, what are the other planned regulation projects that these are going to be included in?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we're also considering a regulation project on HB 56 that was before this committee, I believe, as well. That would be changes for the commercial fishing loan limits.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow-up.
And so, I don't have HB 56 in front of me, so is there a, so I'm assuming there's not a zero fiscal note for HB 56?
Through the chair, Representative, no, it was a zero fiscal note. Again, I was informed that since we were not asking for an additional appropriation, that it was to be a zero fiscal note.
Loans are self-sustaining.
And Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
And I guess the reason I'm asking is that, you know, we hear about the budget and how much has been reduced, and I appreciate that you're absorbing the cost, but, you know, as these things come forward, you know, it would be nice to know, because some people get charged the $5,000 or $10,000, whatever it is, to be able to, in their fiscal notes, and then you get ones like this that aren't. And even, you know, there would have been showing us, you know, that would have been at least designated general funds, because that's right. My understanding where it would be coming out of. So I understand they're wanting to absorb it, but somebody, especially on something like this, the loan people are going to pay for it, so it may not be state UGF that's paying for it, but the loan in some fashion, and it gets very inconsistent when we see some that are being absorbed, some that aren't, so that as they're coming through or we're proposing things, we kind of know what to anticipate ourselves. And I have just one other question. On the other fiscal note, do we have any idea, it says that they there may be more money for the hatchery portion of it I guess until we know, we'll see. I'm sorry. It just says on the second page, this bill will not affect the Department of Fish and Game. I'm sorry, it's Fish and Games, but may provide additional operating funds for operators of hatcheries supplying aquatic plants or shellfish to an aquatic farm. And I guess, Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, and she's with the Department of Commerce, not Fish and Game. So whatever money goes to hatcheries, does that go, and maybe Representative Ortiz knows, does that go back into the hatcheries themselves? Is that why it states that there may be more money for them mm-hmm. versus the state?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, are you now referring to
2175? It's just on the second page. Because it gives a zero fiscal note, but it talks about now this would be actually revenue that perhaps would be coming in. But it doesn't look like it comes into the state. It looks like it may come into the hatcheries.
Briefings.
House Finance is back on record. Representative Ortiz and then Guttenberg.
Thank you, Chairman Foster. I'm going to defer to my staff person, Elizabeth Bowling, who will attempt at answering Representative Wilson's question.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, hatcheries will be able to apply for grants through this reshaped loan fund, and although those grants are small, it would be possible for them to get some small grant money through this program that they may otherwise receive from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. So all that this fiscal note is saying is that a portion of the amount that they pay out to these hatcheries to operate might be offset a little bit by this grant program.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Here, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having Commerce's subcommittee, this is a revolving loan fund, which means it loans money out, it brings it back in, loans it out, brings it back in. It's self-sustaining. It operates by itself. It doesn't need sustained level of general fund appropriations unless something comes up and it wants to, or we decide to give it something for something else. But they have been given at one point, and I don't know the whole history, but the amount of money to operate, and it operates self-contained. So we're just expanding who can use it and how it's used, but it is whether it's the new regs or anything else it's doing, it's self-sustaining. You know, if there was an aspect of the loan fund that this bill would diminish or require more uses of or expenditure of, we would see that, or hopefully we would see that. But the loan fund by itself, it's just a bank. And it's a revolving loan fund. It gives out loans. It brings them in. It operates as itself, as it was an independent agency. That's the way it's set up. Thank you.
Do we have any further questions of the committee? Representative Wilson?
Well, just on that point, and Representative Guttenberg is correct. That would be DGF, but DGF is shown in our fiscal notes. And that was the only point that I had, that if it's going to come from a fund, we should just know the name of the fund, and we do put DGF in stat. So just make a clarification. But that does show up in fiscal notes. Thank you.
Any further questions on the fiscal notes? Hearing none, I would entertain a motion to move the bill from committee.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Seaton.
I move CS for House Bill 76, Fish Version 30, LS0343/I from House Finance with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Are there any objections?
Oh, it's not a zero. Or yeah.
Okay. Hearing no objections. The CS for House Bill number 76, Fisheries Version 30-LS0343/I is in India, is reported from House Finance Committee with individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal notes. So with that, let's take a brief at ease, allow people to sign the report and brief at ease. House Finance is back on record, and our final piece of business today is HB 124, the Benefit Corporations Bill. We last heard this bill on April 17, 2017, and there is one amendment for this bill that I will be offering. It's being passed out right now. And so at this time, I'd like to call Representative Quito and his aide, Bianca Carpinetti, to the table. And if you could both put yourselves on the record and refresh the committee on HB 124, and then we'll move to questions and the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and it's a pleasure to be here before you and House Finance again this afternoon. House Bill 124, we had introduced at a previous meeting, really just basically establishes a charter type of corporation that will allow a company to have within its bylaws and within its operations plan, within its activities, more than just a fiduciary responsibility to its shareholders. They will also be allowed under the B Corp statute to provide a public benefit, and that public benefit will be defined in the organizing documents of the corporation, and we've covered several questions. We do have, are we going to be entertaining the amendment that you've got before you? I think what I will do is defer to my staff, Ms. Carpinetti, who's done a lot of work at the technical level on the bill, and she'll be able to present our position on the amendment, and then we can both answer any questions that might be asked regarding the bill.
Real good. I just want to let folks know that available for questions also are Janie Hovenden, Division Director of Corporation Businesses and Professional Licensing, as well as Kevin Anselm. She's from the Division of Banking. And so are there any questions on the bill before we move to the amendments? Seeing no questions, I will move amendment number one.
Yeah.
And we have an objection, and if Ms. Carpinetti could please walk us through that. And then I also want to let folks know that also available to speak to the amendment is Senior Counsel Peter Pino from Wells Fargo, and he is online to also answer questions. So with that, Ms. Carpinetti.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Bianca Carpinetti, staff to Representative Quito. The amendment before you is a friendly safe harbor amendment proposed by the Alaska Bankers Association. The proposed language is intended to function much like Alaska's Certificate of Trust statute. In particular, the subsections of that trust statute is AS 1336079 subsections F and G. Basically, these provisions provide third parties transacting business with a trust. They can rely on a trust statement that the transaction is permitted by the trust and, as such, enforceable against the trust. The intent of the amendment is to provide the same contractual certainty to third parties that contract businesses with proposed public benefit corporations. Turning specifically to Article 5, Actions and Claims, Sections 10, 60, 300, 320 of the proposed legislation found on pages 9 and 10, that section provides that parties may bring action against a public benefit corporation for failing to pursue or create a public benefit. In light of the fact that monetary damages are not permitted under the proposed legislation, the likely relief would be injunctive in nature. That relief could theoretically include a court setting aside a contract under the theory that it did not satisfy or further a public benefit. So absent the proposed language, third parties may feel compelled to make an independent assessment of whether the transaction satisfies or furthers a public benefit. So there are some concerns that that sort of analysis may increase the costs of completing transactions and may make some transactions more difficult to complete. So the bill sponsor's position on this is neutral. We consulted with William Clark, who is the lawyer who testified in front of the committee at the last hearing. He's with B Labs, and he indicated that he understood the intent and thought it might go a little bit too far. Specifically, he had concerns about subsection 2, regarding which he noted the non-benefit corporation party to the contract certainly should not have a duty to inquire about the purpose of the contract, but it may say too much to allow the other party to enforce a contract in all cases. If a court declines to enforce a contract, the other party will still be protected because it will be entitled to any damages it can prove, end quote.
So Mr. Clark's suggestion was perhaps to strike subsection 2, although he did note that his concerns were not incredibly serious about it. We also contacted the Department of Commerce to see if they had concerns about the proposed amendment. We received responses from Janie Hovenden with the Division of Corporations, Businesses, and Professional Licensing, and she noted that, quote, the division doesn't see an issue with the proposed changes, close quote. We also heard back from Kevin Anselm with the Division of Banking, and the division requested the addition of subsection 3, which you see on the amendment before you. And both, as the co-chair noted, both of those individuals are online for questions. So that concludes my presentation about the substance of the amendment.
Well, good. I'd like to give Mr. Pino an opportunity if he has any additional questions, and then we'll take questions, or if he has any additional comments, then we'll take questions from the committee. So, Mr. Pino, if you're there, if you could just put yourself on the record, and if you have any comments, you can proceed.
Yes, thank you. This is Peter Pino, P-I-N-N-O-W, with Senior Counsel with Wells Fargo. The only comment that I would make is that in connection with the clause 2 that was referenced in the past presentation, the intent with that clause 2 was to track the same rights and the same protections that are afforded under the trust certificate statute that was referenced as well. So that's where that language was intended. That's what that language was intended to accomplish. So if there are any questions, I'm happy to take that.
Okay, thank you. So does the committee have any questions for Mr. Pino, the bill sponsor, or Division of Professional Licensing, Representative Seaton?
Thank you. Reading this, of course, the benefit, either the general public benefit or the specific public benefit, are not the sole reason for the company's existence. And as I read this, it is a person may assume that each action or inaction by any director or officer of the benefit corporation giving effect to the transaction is in the furtherance of the benefit corporation's general public benefit purpose or specific benefit purpose. And it seems like what we've done, I can understand under trust, you have an obligation to a trust to only do the act on the trust, the beneficiaries of the trust. But here we're talking about an additional benefit that is offered by a corporation, but that's not its sole benefit. And it looks like that this language would actually mean that if a company was making money, somebody that wanted to further either the company's general or specific benefit could actually interfere with the company's right to make a profit, because it isn't in the furtherance of the specific or general benefit purpose. And so maybe someone could address that issue, because I think mixing trusts with the accessory or auxiliary purpose of having a specified benefit in addition to the first general purpose of the corporation is becomes problematic.
And this is Pete Pino, and I can respond to that if you'd like.
Sure, please proceed, Mr. Pino.
Okay, great. I guess I understand the comment, and I think that the concern that we had as we looked at this is that whenever there's a sort of a public benefit requirement imposed by a statute, we always want to make sure that we have contractual certainty, and that we don't ever run the risk of having our contracts set aside with 2020 hindsight. And so what this proposal was intended to do was to just ensure that, you know, parties that are transacting business with a public benefit corporation, that they, you know, can feel safe and secure that the contract that they have entered into with this corporation is not going to be set aside at a later date under the theory that the contract did not further the public benefit. And I think that the intent there is really just to is just to make sure that there's contractual certainty. And I think that the reason why I analogize this to the trust certificate is that much like parties that transact business with trusts, you know, they need contractual certainty that the transaction has been authorized and is in furtherance of the trust purpose. You know, here in this instance, you know, we as a third party who would be interacting and lending money to the public benefit corporation, we'd want to make sure that we have that certainty as well. And so, you know, just like a third party who is relying on a trust certificate can assume that the contract or that the transaction is in furtherance of the trust purpose, we'd love the same thing here with regard to this public benefit corporation. So I hope that answers your question.
Follow up, Representative Seaton.
And my follow up is, but the general benefit and specific benefit are additional or accessory values to the operation of the corporation. It's not the sole purpose of the corporation is to do the general or specific benefit. And the way you've written it here, it is saying that the entirety of the contract has to be going for accomplishing this accessory benefit that the corporation has established. It's not the sole purpose, like a trust has a sole purpose. But here you're converting the general benefit or the specific benefit into the sole purpose of the company, and that everything under the contract has to go to that. And so I'm worried that we are trying to convert the corporation from having an accessory portion that it can invest or can have investment that goes to that benefit to that's the only thing that they can do. So can you explain to me how that wouldn't be the interpretation of this trust language that you've proposed?
Well, sure, absolutely. I don't think that or at least it certainly wasn't the intent that this language would require that a public benefit corporation only engage in transactions that serve a public benefit. I think that the purpose of this language is intended to make it clear and provide third parties with the protection that their contract right is not going to be set aside because of the fact that the contract in question perhaps did not go to did not further the public benefit objective. So I don't, this language shouldn't be interpreted as, you know, fundamentally changing the requirements of a public benefit corporation. It really is intended solely to provide protection to third parties that are transacting with a public benefit corporation.
Follow-up, Representative Seaton.
So you're saying that on line 5 where it says they can assume without inquiry that the transaction and each action or inaction by any director or officer, that doesn't mean what it says, that's each action or inaction by any director or officer of the benefit corporation is in the furtherance of that public general or specific public benefit. I mean, that's the way I read it. That's what it's pretty clear.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I see your point is that the contract might be for benefit of the corporation, but the contract does not it does not further the public benefit and purpose. And I guess my concern with that is that maybe flip it around. We certainly don't want to ever have our contract set aside because somebody argues that the contract did not serve a public benefit, and that's really the primary concern.
And so, Mr. Chairman,
hold on.
And I don't have any problem with that, but I just don't think that this language accomplishes that. So, Mr. Chairman, I would object to adopting this specific language at this time, and that when we're talking about corporate requirements and third-party reliance and everything, I think that we should get this redrafted by Ledge Legal to say specifically what we would want that to say. And I think taking out the trust language is mixing apples and oranges, and I'm so I have some problems with the specifics of the way the language, not with the purpose of what it's being offered for, but with the specifics of the language. And I can't rewrite it right now. I think that legal wouldn't need to do it.
So I'd like to ask the sponsor if he has any, I guess, thoughts. One option is we could set this aside for now and have the amendment redrafted, or we could proceed. I just want to get your thoughts on.
Mr. Co-Chair, given where we are at with our current session situation and the fact that this bill is not necessary for this year, I'd be content with setting the bill aside and giving us a chance to take another run at the language. See if we can come up with something that Representative Seaton's more comfortable with.
Representative Guttenberg, did you have a question?
Well, maybe to Mr. Pinto, but just simply along the lines of Representative Seaton's observations, just listening to Ms. Carpinetti's summation of the comments that she got, drew me in, and it's like, okay, so at best it's neutral and cloudy and maybe making it more obscure. We're setting this up, and when I'm reading through it, certainly A2 looks to me, and Mr. Pinto's comments was it's not the intent, but it certainly feels like that's the could certainly be the result of a third party negating a benefit corporation's purpose. And that was my concern, that someone would come in, enter a transaction with a benefit corporation, and then be able to enforce the transaction as 2A2 says, enforce the transaction against the benefit corporation, whether it's its general purpose or specific purpose, but override the really at the end of the day the purpose of the corporation with just because of third parties. Does a business transaction with it. Mr. Pinto, is that could that be read that way? I know that's not the intent that you're trying to do, but I'm concerned that that could be the intent of somebody coming in and taking that position.
I don't think so, and the reason I believe that is because of the fact that this language speaks to the public benefit purpose or the specific public benefit purpose, and so it really this language is intended, and I think deals solely with whether or not a particular transaction furthers the public benefit purpose, and so if there are other concerns about a contract that would otherwise apply under, general corporate law, this language should not be interpreted to address that. It really is just intended to deal with the specific and I think unique characteristics of these public benefit corporations in that they have a public benefit purpose requirement that can be enforced by shareholders.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there further questions? So, Mr. Pinno, your entire question here is just to make sure that when someone enters a transaction with the benefit corporation, that transaction, that specific transaction, does not have to further either the general public benefit purpose or the specific specific benefit purpose to be valid. So they could enter into a transaction and be doing things without having that set aside because it didn't specifically, let's say someone was trying to maintain trails around Juneau and the corporation had that as their specific benefit and they were doing a transaction, let's say it's a laundromat, and it is into an agreement with a hotel, and the hotel's transaction didn't specifically deal with the maintaining of trails around Juneau, that couldn't be used as a cause of action in the case. Is that what you're trying to get to, is so that wouldn't invalidate the contract, that the benefit corporation wasn't specifically using that transaction to further the specific benefit? Is that where we're
trying? Yes. Yes, I mean, that's really the concern for us is that we just want certainty that, so for instance, if we lend money to a public benefit corporation to do an addition, build a parking ramp or do something, that somebody later questions the public benefit from that transaction. We certainly don't want to have any specific transaction or any specific contract set aside or called into question as being ultra vires or outside of the corporate authority simply because of the fact that it with hindsight did not accomplish or achieve or further a public benefit.
Hey, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
Mr. Chairman, I think I understand where you're trying to go with that. I think that we can accomplish that through Ledge Legal, and it shouldn't delay very long, this process, because I think that that can easily be resolved, but without this exact language, it could be misinterpreted in reverse. So, thank you.
Any further questions of the committee? Representative Wilson?
Just on that point, if we could get it a little early, whenever that comes, so that we could go to our own bankers back home, just to make sure that they've been able to see it since that's the issue that was raised, so that we get it right. Thank you.
Any further questions of the committee? Seeing none, we will set aside HB 124.
Mr. Chairman, shouldn't we withdraw the amendment at this point, since we're going to write a new one?
Yes, and since I moved the amendment, I will withdraw my amendment, and we will have Ledge Legal look at that and work on the language. So with that, is there any other further business to come before the committee? Seeing none, our next regularly scheduled House Finance Committee meeting is at 1:30 p.m. on Thursday, April 27th. At this meeting, we'll be hearing HB 159, which is the Opioids, Prescriptions, Databases, and Licenses Bill, as well as HB 25, the Insurance Coverage for Contraceptives. And so with that, we will be recessed at 2:39 p.m. Thank you, everyone.